kill Jay-Z. They'll never love you, you'll never be enough. Let's just keep it real, Jay-Z.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, all 100 yachts of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
You had no father, you had the armor. But you got a daughter, gotta get softer. Die, Jay-Z. This ain't back in the days. You don't need an alibi, Jay-Z. Cry, Jay-Z. We know the pain is real, but you can't heal what you never revealed. What's up, Jay-Z? You know you owe the truth to all the youth that fell in love with Jay-Z. You got people you love, you sold drugs to. You got high in life, that's your drug you. You walking around like you invincible. You dropped out of school, you lost your principles. I know people backstab you, I felt that too. But this for everybody attitude ain't natural. But you ain't the same, this ain't kumbaya.
Kill Jay-Z, better to analyze Jay-Z. I am Millie rocking live at Sunset Gower Studios. This is sort of a dream podcast for me. I hope it will be a dream podcast for you. I am joined by three of my dearest friends for a conversation about really whatever the hell we want to talk about today, starting with Jay-Z. To my right, it's Sean Fennessy, editor-in-chief of The Ringer and host of the Big Picture podcast.
Hello. Welcome. What's up?
Staring me down, it is top 500 podcaster, Chris Ryan.
What's up, man?
Executive editor of The Ringer and co-host of The Watch Pod.
Is it top 500?
Are your numbers going up? Are you top 300?
Yeah, it depends on which charts you're looking at.
Wow.
Yeah, but the Malaysian recreational pod charts, we're strong. Like platinum. But okay. It's great to be here.
I'm going to link out to all the podcast rankings on the article page.
Cool.
So like, I really hope by the time this goes live that number hasn't changed at all.
Okay.
Should we compare numbers on podcast versus The Watch?
No, see, here's the thing with podcast numbers. The only people who listen to it are influencers.
That's right.
So right. When that happens, sometimes your numbers are a little low, which is fine. To my left, doesn't host a podcast.
Yet.
Zach Barron, staff writer at GQ.
What are podcasts, though?
Yeah, seriously.
Zach's actually got a serious drive time sports radio show that's really popular.
Here's the thing. I assure you that in the next hour, you will not get an answer to that question.
ZB in the machine.
Yeah. ZB. Speedy Z.
ZB and Christy, the tri-state area's greatest sports talk.
There's going to be a lot of loose conversation on this week's podcast. Let's start by talking about Jay-Z, who is an artist of, I would say, high meaning to everybody at this table. 444 came out a couple weeks ago. Sprint bought a bunch of copies, and now it's platinum. So shouts to Sprint.
Congratulations to all phones.
Anyone here a Sprint subscriber? I feel like we should disclose. Anybody here use Sprint?
No, I gave just switched from Nextel Chirp to my iPhone recently.
So gotcha.
I have an iPhone 4. It's already out of space, but I'm hoping to download Jay-Z sometime in 2019. It's exciting.
Yeah, when it comes to Sidekick.
Actually, if you sign up for Metro PCS, you actually get a physical bootleg of the Jay-Z record.
Oh, that's
really
cool.
Nice.
When I was
Jay-Z
on,
stabbed you.
I was just on a flight.
Shouts to Lance Rivera.
To Vegas. And there was a bunch of guys there who were doing like DJ sets at various hotels over the weekend. It was for Summer League. And they were talking.
That sounds pretty cool. DJ sets in Las Vegas. That sounds like a cool guy thing to
do. It was like they were definitely cool guys. They were doing Instagram stories from the flight.
This was the first time there were DJ sets in Vegas, right?
Yeah,
first time
it was
ever.
Inaugural.
They have DJ sets in Vegas.
Yeah. Wow. And these guys were like, hey, man, do you play anything off of 444? And they're like, yeah, you know, I play a little bit. I played Marcy and Me yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, maybe people would have, and they were talking about whether people had heard it yet and whether it was like, and he was like, but really it was just like, I felt like I needed to play a Jay-Z song at the club. But it was like this weird
like a moral imperative
or almost this weird act of charity. You know what I mean?
Damn.
Like they were like, I guess like I wanted to see, but in the end of the day, I would not have felt good about myself if I hadn't played something off. So that's where we're at.
So yeah, that's really, grandpa's that really, DJing in Vegas.
Augurs well for the tour.
Yeah, exactly.
So basically, it's old folks DJing in Las Vegas.
These guys were younger than me, but I guess I'm old.
Shout to Mighty Mai and John Schechter, all my friends in Vegas DJing. Maybe DJing a Jay-Z song right now.
Yeah.
Salute to them. Jay-Z, I want to say, like, I'm the only person of our foursome that remains in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
The non-traitorious part of the foursome. So I will say I actually have heard Jay-Z coming out of car windows, which is like one of those like sort of non-metric metrics.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a real thing. I feel like I've heard it quite a bit. You know, there's a new taco spot around the corner from the house. You know, they were playing some Jay-Z. You know, it's in the sort of collective consciousness more than I
were
was
people playing the record or was it coming off the radio?
No, they were playing the record.
Okay.
When they first announced it, my initial feeling was, is this a thing? This could very easily just not be a thing. Like, this could just come and go. But I feel like that hasn't happened. And I wonder why, if you guys are picking that up, and why you think that was the case.
I've actually had the opposite experience. So the day after the record came out...
You played DJ Quick all day, and you're like, the hell with this.
No. I mean, maybe I should have done that, but I was in Flight Club on Fairfax looking at...
Flex!
At Jordan 11s.
Flex!
And the record was on a loop there. And when it ended... I was in there for a little longer than I should have been.
People wept.
When it ended, I heard the two people who worked there say, this is shorter than I realized. Let's run it back. That was not really like my reaction to the album. I didn't have emotional imperative to.
Really?
Which is something that I've had probably with every Jay-Z album, even the ones I don't really like that
even
much.
Even Kingdom Come.
Yeah. I mean, you and I were working together when Kingdom Come came out, and I remember trying to go back to find things I loved about it because my reaction was so poor. And this one, there's just something a little less essential and urgent going on here. It feels new.
That's strange. I feel different about
that. But do you feel like that has something more to do with Jay-Z's place in the consciousness or this particular record?
I think it says as much about me as it does about Jay-Z, unfortunately, right. Which is maybe I don't have the same desire to return to these things the way that I once did. But
did you buy the Jordan 11s, though?
Yeah.
I walked out with nothing. So that was it was a loss all around.
You don't really seem like a Jordan 11
I was
guy.
Trying something new, you know, but I was experiencing something old. Jay, a sound from my past, looking toward the future.
I feel confident that if you were trying on Jordan 8s or Jordan 3s or 2s when you were listening to Jay-Z record, you both would have bought sneakers and wanted to rewind the Jay-Z record.
Never 2s, but maybe 3s.
I mean, 2s are ugly, but still, they're era appropriate. Who liked the Jay-Z record?
I mean, what Sean was saying made me think, though, about the thing that I kind of maybe is the problem with the record, which is, like, I like confident, upbeat, energetic Jay. And I think that, obviously, we've been fascinated with him. As long as we've been fascinated with him, a record that, like, pulls back the curtain, which is what this is kind of amazing. But it's also kind of like, when you don't hit play again, it's like you never felt that adrenaline that is what that artist is so great at. And I also wonder if that's like the Vegas problem. You know, it's like beyond BPMs. It's just like, it's kind of like.
Yo, BPMs are low.
They are low.
They low. Yeah. I literally did the thing. You know those websites where you can like tap out the BPMs? I did that on every single song.
What was the highest? 88?
There's one random song that's like 98, but everything else is from 72 to 82, basically.
Yeah. You can feel that. The tone and the pulse of it is much lower.
But is there a possibility that this record is doing exactly what it was designed to do, which is be like late period Tom Petty for rap fans?
100%.
Yeah, and it's like probably his only option. I mean, Magna Carta, Holy Grail, which is like a reach for that energy. Yeah, and it's rough. It's tough. So, yeah, it may be like even No ID is probably like saying like, yeah, we got to slow this down a little bit and make it a little bit more intimate. Play to your strengths.
Yeah.
This is like the thing that you can still do really well. And there are moments on that record that are incredible.
Do you think that was something that, I wonder if it's something that Jay-Z came to organically in his thought process or had to be nudged?
Like boxed in by his producers.
Yeah, because if you read those No ID Q&As, the one that we did, and there's another one, Rolling Stone, there is this kind of like, I gave him this thing and sort of forced his
and
hand.
You could almost hear some edits on the record. I mean, there are times where you can almost hear like, two vocal tracks getting run into each other, you know, where someone's kind of being like, let's tighten this up. Let's get rid of some extraneous stuff. Like, I almost feel like you can hear the 30% of that record that got edited out after it was recorded.
How much do you think this matters in terms of your reading of Jay-Z's career going into it? Because I think that we're at a table with four people who probably have a very, like, Jay-Z died at Black album. You know, like, that was supposed to be his self-penned obit.
Came back to life with Watch the Throne.
Yeah, and then he came back to life with Watch the Throne, but like
that's like Peter Thiel with Young Person's Blood.
Yeah.
No comment on that comment.
Sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. But this is like if Lazarus was hanging out by the cave still doing magic tricks. You know what I mean? Like we've now gotten to the point.
Actually, I don't.
But we're like way past.
Who was Lazarus again?
Didn't Jesus bring him back to life? Wait, are you asking like if he's like a SoundCloud rapper?
I think you're on the wrong podcast. Yeah. So you would like to talk about Peter Thiel and you would like to talk about the Bible.
Did Ronnie J produce Lazarus's album?
My point is basically that we are on like, this is like the Late Late Show. And if you view Jay-Z's career as sort of ending a huge part of it with Black Album and then this solar flare that happens with Watch the Thrones, like it's hard to judge Magna Carta and Kingdom Come and this within that context, right? Because you're thinking like, what is this? How is he positioning himself? Is he positioning himself as like, look, I'm putting something out to like reinforce corporate ties, to do a lucrative tour behind because it gives me a peg to tour off of? Or is he like, I believe that rap can go into middle age. And I believe that rap can be a viable platform for middle age.
Well, I think like many savvy business people, you, I don't know, pivot when you have a decision that you've made that is a failure. And I think it's widely acknowledged that the last Jay-Z record was a failure. It's also widely acknowledged that he basically got his ass handed to him by his wife. And so you really don't have loads of options. Like when I was thinking, when the record was first announced, I was thinking of the myriad ways it could have unfolded. And I thought the only play that he really genuinely has is to do this kind of experimental, grown-up record, or to do something that's purely an emotional answer to Lemonade. Those are his only plays.
I also do think that Chris is right, though. It's like he's always been an artist, I think, interested in being like, what does it look like if I take this further than the next person took it? And that's what retiring was about. No rapper had ever been successful enough to retire before he did it. And then coming back was him being like, oh, actually, there's these business opportunities and I've become an arena artist and let me explore that. And I feel like this is a self-conscious, what did these guys do? What did Johnny Cash do after he was Johnny Cash, whatever? I feel like he's definitely thinking about that and probably takes pride in the way that he's leading the way once again and saying hey, you might not be able to run with 21 Savage or whatever, but.
Right. Yes, I think this is connected to the previous question too, which is that I suspect that it was No ID's idea to have a single streamlined sound, and that Jay-Z, who has always valorized the concept of the album and consistency, it didn't take long to convince him of that. The record that I don't know if it's been compared to this album before, but the one that it reminds me of the most, the way it's been received and the way that it's sort of been promoted and marketed, is Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind, which was a comeback of sorts for an artist who had completely lost relevance, who many people thought was done making interesting music. Not a huge fan of Time Out of Mind, but I remember specifically being elated to the way it was positioned in the world by the critical community.
The
work
that it does.
And then the Grammys. And it was a serious artist grappling with mortality and relevance in a specific way that seemed managed, but also honest. And that's kind of what this is, too.
It's not a thing that's happening in rap. I mean, in a way, unless maybe you could say late period Scarface is maybe someone who did this.
Yeah.
But it's not
lower stakes.
This actually leads me to a question, which is, I work by myself in a small room and don't talk to anybody during the day most of the time.
Wow.
Give Zach a hug. Everybody out there, give Zach a hug. At Zach Barron, give him a hug.
Zach Barron presents Time Out of Mind.
But, you guys work with other humans, young humans especially.
It's
I'm curious, what are the young people that you work with? How do they react to this record? Because the Bob Dylan thing's interesting, right? We didn't really live with the beginning of the Bob Dylan career, so that record, part of it was confusing because we were just okay,
it was forced on us. It was just we were told immediately, this is an album of the year candidate.
I wonder,
that was by the time we were all probably thinking about things in terms of top 10 lists or what deserves to win Paz and Jop or whatever. And that was just out of the gate, we will not be putting this up on the floor for debate. This is one of the albums of the year. And it was just kind of I was all right, cool.
But so my old man question is, if you're 23 or you're 25, does this record make a lick of sense to you?
I think if you are historically inclined, then yes. And if you're not, then it is probably meaningless. Because I don't think it doesn't really have the PSA or the banger that I think
Otis
would draw people in.
Yeah. I mean, the Damian Marley song is sort of the closest to that.
And I like that song. And I actually, it doesn't feel like a reach to me with him trying to do that style. But it is weird that somebody basically already did a version. Kanye did a version of that song fairly recently.
Let's actually listen to the Damian Marley collaboration with Bomb.
Now greetings to the world. Gangsta no live in a tenement yard. Hood boy no live in a tenement yard. Too much watchy. Too much so. Our them chatty.
Girl is pretty sharp. Caught a shit. The hoe. Sean was on that gospel shoot. I was on the total opposite. Stuff $1 million in a sock drawer. That's a war chest in case you need your chest knocked off. Y'all be talking crazy under them IG pictures. So when you get the hell, you tell them Blanco sent you. I can't take no threats, I got a set of twins. Those were just some words you'll never hear again. For the final time, you don't believe these fools. I never seen a worker rock so many jewels. Ever. I never seen a runner with so many cars. Ever. Y'all couldn't stop me, you're not as tough as you say you are. My advice is just don't be too nice to niggas. Just set the price on you to live your life, my. Once upon a time in the
process. We always look at these things as kind of like a pendulum, or like Jay's providing an antidote maybe for older rap fans. And when Zach asked that question, one of the things that jumps into my mind is that there isn't a shortage of lyrical rap necessarily for people who want it, who are younger. I mean, like, that's one of the funny things I was looking at. We just got out of NBA free agency, so there's been all these roundups of players' Snapchats and stuff like that. And there was one of LeBron sitting at this beachside bar somewhere, and he's smoking a cigar listening to Friday Night Lights by J. Cole. He's just like one of the top five albums ever. LeBron's a little younger than us, but for someone even of his age and younger, that version of this might have far more relevance to their lives just because of what it documented in their coming of age. That's always going to be the most important music to you. So the reason why we're even talking about Jay, despite how important he is and how important he is to streaming music and how important he is in terms of the celebrity firmament, we're talking about him because of what his first four albums meant to us, right? Like, that's why
you mean
is relevant.
We specifically.
Yeah, the reason the four of us and the reason people of our generation are like, it's time to stop what I'm doing on a Thursday night and listen to this new Jay-Z record as soon as it comes out is because of what he meant to us at a very formative time of our lives.
I don't know. I feel like that's true maybe of the people sitting at this table, but I think generally speaking, this album and Jay-Z as a figure has penetrated broader consciousness, even to people who are not our age, not our generation.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And also, a lot of that has to do with the animus created by his wife and sort of in making him a character in this sort of like long running telenovela about celebrity marriage mishaps. And I think a decent amount of the attention and energy on this Jay record is, what's he going to say? It's he's part of a conversation. You've been basically waiting for the text, the three bubbles to turn into a text. And now it finally
happens. Also, it's worth pointing out, Jay hasn't done an interview with the single publication in 4 years, 6 years.
It's been a long time.
It's been a really long time. So not only have people not really heard music, Jay hasn't talked in public at all before this record.
But that's actually really notable because this album in particular, and this is something, Zach, you and I talked about last week when we were talking about the album. This is actually, I find the album is much better to talk about and dissect than it is to listen to. And that it's, you know, it's kind of hacky to say that this is therapy for him, given his reliance on talking about therapy on the record. But there's clearly an effort to actualize himself on the album in a way that there never has been. So talking about infidelity, talking about his mom's sexual preferences, talking about his decision to kind of reflect on who he is now as an aging man, fatherhood, all these things that
even the rap, his flows are mumblecore in this. You know, like there's such like a conversational tone to it. And you think of Lemonade, and I associate Lemonade with these sort of working in iconography and working in like these huge widescreens and like the very visual and imagery heavy album. And this is so navel-gazy. And this is so like, you can tell, Zach, you were talking about the vocal tracks. You can tell like he's like chatting his way into song.
It's a spoken record in many ways. And it's funny because my first listen to this record, I kept thinking, he's not rapping good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the rapping's not good.
That's also why it's like that's time out of mind. Though, no, you know? I know. Like, the singing sucks on this album.
And then I realized that's the point. And it took a full second listen, especially because when you hear how desiccated the production is, there's something very intentional about the scarcity and roughness and abrasion of what No ID is doing on a production level. And I think Jay-Z understood that to over rap on that, I think he's still capable of rapping. He probably takes some more effort than it used to. I think he's still capable of it. But I think that he realized to over rap on these beats would be a complete mismatch.
Yeah. And it's an artist who has done things on his own terms, basically his own career, and kind of has almost seemed like without influences, like after like Biggie in some ways, like a lot of artists came and went. He didn't really adapt a ton of that. He was just sort of like went deeper into what Jay was. And this is the first one where it's like, I got to deal with like the Beyonce stuff and I got to deal with the Kanye stuff. And I got to sort of take this template that No ID like is basically saying in interviews that he like kind of forced on him. And just like figure out how to be an artist over this. It's like really the first Jay record that you get the sense that he's not dictating. He's just responding and reacting. And it's just like a very weird mode for a guy who is just like proclaimed from on high. It's basically since the beginning.
We should listen to Caught Their Eyes, which I feel is one of the best songs on the record to that point.
Ready for it. Ready for it.
With the V side, with that Lee side. Talking about that Lee side, with that V side, with that East side.
times they pretend that we can, but the vibes don't fly, bro. I survive being guys like you.
So there's something really interesting about this too, which is his sort of existential sighing towards youth culture.
Yeah.
And you know, you noted in
unfamiliar with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you noted in your piece, and it's something that I picked up on right away when I first listened to it, the sort of like,
you know, kids on your
rappers
Insta-
on the Instagram with the money to your ears, and that line in particular is such the get off my lawn thing. On the other hand, you know, he had that burst on Twitter when he was inducted into the Songwriters Hall
of Fame.
I can't hear you.
What? Yeah,
there's money on John's ear right now. It is sadly a $1 bill.
Yeah.
Shout out Diddy. Yeah.
But then when Jay was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, he shouted out a series of influences, you know, among them like Big Daddy Kane and Biggie, but also Playboy Cardi, and there's
Magnolia,
you know, acknowledgement
incredible.
Of Magnolia's of Magnolia's greatness, right? So it's when you're 45 or 50, how do you reflect on what cool young kids are doing?
Okay, but that's why this. Okay, so there is a version of this record, I thought, and I mentioned this in my piece. If Jay had done an equivalent style album, say circa 08-09, he could have very feasibly done like a post Wayne kind of like, oh, you do this? I do this.
Yeah.
He easily could have done that. There's a version of this where he takes Thug, Cardi, all this stuff that's sort of like beyond post-structural and says, okay, I'm going to do it in some other way. Like, y'all want to make an entire song out of ad-libs? Like, watch
but
me make an
entire song.
But that
stuff in and of itself now is post-structural. Like, when you listen to that SoundCloud, like, we're gonna talk about some of these dudes, but a lot of the people who are interrogating that sound are already doing that. And, like, it's moved beyond any kind of template, right? Like, if you listen to 21 Savage, it's not like that sounds like something that... That doesn't sound like 08 Wayne. You know what I mean?
On God.
That sounds like something that's being chirped out of a Blade Runner advertisement. It doesn't sound like anything. I don't understand how you subvert that music. And in fact, I would almost argue that the key would be to take something like that and do the Thrones thing where you make it arena rock again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there was no way he could have adopted it. There's no way he could have taken Savage's flow or Cardi's flow or any those things are not applicable to what Jay does.
As I see, I actually disagree, because I think one of the things that Jay has done so well over the course of his career is be like, oh, you want a Texas flow? Yeah, I can do a Texas flow. Like, oh, you want a Louisiana flow? Like, I can do that. Oh, you want a California flow? Like, I can do that. And I think there's no reason that Jay at his peak, which he is not, but Jay at his peak could have said, oh, you want this anti-flow? Yeah, I can do a lyrical anti-flow.
I feel like maybe we got it, and that was just kind of the ramble mumble stuff that you're talking about. Maybe. If that's the closest we can get, then that's how much of a formalist he is that he can't break himself free.
Yeah, and I think that's like what he's mad about on the record. He's just like, he's just like, nah.
Y'all not even rapping, you know? And y'all have money on your ear.
Yeah, exactly. And like, Jay was not always the paragon of like lyricism, you know? I mean, in his day, he was like, I simplified it. Everybody got mad at him for simplifying it. It's not like foreign to him.
Double my dollars.
Yeah, but he's just like, nah. And you it's all over there. He's just like, you're not real. You're not like, you can't rap with me, even though at this point,
probably could.
The thing that I would want to put in like a museum case and just walk around for a while and try to figure out what was going on there is the big quote at the beginning of Marcy Me. That's just kind of like, it's almost as if he's reading off of a cue card preparing for the actual recording to start.
Oh.
And it's kind of, you know, somebody who's dealt with Big's influence, his rivalry, his ghost, his, you know, all throughout, especially the peak of his career where a lot of people were like, you're just, you know, his last detractors were always just like, you're not even ever going to be as good as Biggie. To hear him kind of like going through the motions of this thing that he'd always made his own, which were these like kind of big references that he would slot into songs and put at the end of bars. It was really fascinating because I was just like, what are you trying to say here by the way that you're quoting him? And I still haven't unpacked that. It's strange to think now. It's like there are kids who listen to rap music who don't know Biggie as someone who was alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's wild.
Shouts to Lil Boat.
I took it as just a declaration of just like, this is the space that I'm in. This is the headspace.
Yeah.
This is the time period. These are the references. I'm unapologetic, you know.
Also, I feel like, and I hate to say this because Jay-Z is very important to me, but I sometimes don't think there's subtext with Jay-Z. I think Jay-Z is a great rapper who's interested in making like a huge commercial product. But I don't know that from a narrative perspective or from a kind of like, the powers of interpretation perspective. I'm not sure that that's where he's the strongest.
Purposeful or unpurposeful?
I mean purposeful.
Because I think that there is something that is missing from this album that has never been missing before. And it speaks a little bit to that kind of crisis of age thing, which is Jay-Z, in large part, is defined by competition and the quest to vanquish competition and to be the best. And in an album where you're saying, like, this is the real me, and here are the things that I've done that are bad, here are the things that I've done that I don't know how to reconcile, it's impossible for him to say, I'm the greatest of all time. Like, that's so incongruous with the philosophy of the record. And it almost feels like him intoning Biggie in a way is almost like he feels closer to him than ever. You know, it's almost like I'm gone now.
For sure.
And
oh, interesting.
As opposed to, and the same thing with sort of talking about young rappers and Instagram, and he's just like, that part of my life is over, and I have to figure out how to be a different kind of artist.
Isn't this the greatest frustration of like the everyday struggle set, though, where it's just like the problem is that this younger generation is actually uninterested in, they're not just not playing by the rules of the game, they don't care about that game. They're not trying to best, you know, like the ideas that somebody gets frustrated by what some of these guys are interested in, what they value, what they think is good music. They're like, you can't play the same game with them because they're just like, yeah,
right.
It's not.
Although
like,
I wonder how that will change 3 years from now, because the thing is, you don't have a second wave of like the Yachty generation or the SoundCloud kids. Like, they haven't matured into like genuine mainstream rap hit makers or just figures. They're still the opposition. They're still the up and comers. And I wonder what will happen when that generation of kids actually becomes the people who have mortgages and actually have to like hold down the responsibility.
We'll have traveled into the sun by then.
I kind of think to like Sean's point, like Jay's peers are not other rappers at this point. I mean, Jay's a famous person. Jay's peers are like Barack Obama. Jay's peers are, I mean, Bono, to talk about another. I don't mean like in terms of historical importance. I'm just talking about in terms of who he sees.
Yeah, Magic Johnson.
Yeah,
spaces
that he
and
moves
his adversaries
in
are like Johann von Spotify or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that on some level, yeah. God damn Johann von Spotify. That's
blocking
like
him on
I think
Instagram.
That's who he's thinking about. That's who he's talking about. Talking to his wife, who's in a similar situation that he is, and that's the air he breathes, and that's like, I mean, Kanye is dealing with like a bizarro world version of the same problem of when you sort of build your career on conversations with other musicians and competition and trying to get in, and then all of a sudden, it's really like work about who your neighbors are and like how you lock down a whole hospital wing when you have a kid, you know.
Stuck off the realness, we be the infamous, you heard of us, official Queensbridge murderers, the mob comes equipped for warfare, beware of my crime family who got enough shots to share for all those who wanna profile and pose, rock you in your face, stab your brain with your nose bone, you all alone in these streets, cousin, every man for theyself in his land, we be gunning, and keep them shook crews running like they supposed to, they come around but they never come close to. I can see it inside your face, you're in the wrong place. Cowards like you just get their whole body laced up with bullet holes and such. Speak the wrong words, man, and you will get touched. You can put your whole army against my team, and I guarantee you it'll be your very last time breathing. Your simple words just don't move me. You're minor, we major. You're all up in the game and don't deserve to be a player. Don't make me have to call your name out. Your crew is featherweight. My gunshots will make you levitate.
Okay, and we're back, and that was Chuck One's Part 2 by Mobb Deep. Prodigy of Mobb Deep died a couple weeks ago, and again, I know Prodigy is someone important to everybody at this table. I definitely had a emotional conversation on the phone with Chris the day of Prodigy's death, and I know I took it very hard. It's interesting to think about Mobb Deep and Jay-Z having been at the same, basically, career rung at the time of this record. Maybe Mobb Deep even a little above Jay-Z.
I would argue that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you would. Chris is like about to flip the table.
Yeah. Speaking of competition too, I mean, two pitted foes at one time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Jay had such a profound effect on Prodigy's career in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm. For good and bad.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I don't have like a big think that I want to put on Prodigy that we haven't already put in the world, but I imagine you guys all would like to speak a little bit about Prodigy. Chris, I know it hit you hard, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, I would just say that we've known each other for like almost 20 years now. And like, you know, we've all been writing about music actively for most of that time. And I think we always are ordering things and talking about things. We just spent a lot of time talking about Jay-Z's relevance and the context around it. But at the end of the day, I do think that there are some voices that just speak to you on a very deep level. And you kind of don't care if the record is the best record of the year or the third best record of the year or whatever. And there's been a handful of rappers that like I've just connected with very deeply, and they don't ever make sense. It's like there's no real reason why Cormega and Pusha are more important to me than Jay, you know, or Nas, you know, but that's the case. And for Prodigy, it was just a very, very deep, visceral connection to him, on both on a lyrical level and the way he sort of wrote about the world and wrote about his life, but also just like on a sonic level and like the way that his voice matched up with Havoc and Alchemist's production to create a world that you would just kind of lose yourself in, you know. And I think he had that effect on a lot of people. There's no accident that this is the song that's playing at the beginning of 8 Mile. There's no accident that this is still a song that like is one of the undefeated tracks in rap history. Like there's no there are no detractors of that song. And like pressed, most people would say it's probably like a top 5 rap song. But for me, it went much deeper. You know, he was a part of my life at a time when like I thought, you know, I was in my 20s and early 30s, and like, you know, you're much more in touch with your kind of the waves of emotion that are going through you, and he was very much like a narrator for that. And it's a profound loss. It's like, and he was also like aging well, I thought. You know what I mean? I thought he was like a real steward of the music. So it really sucks, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear you talk about that. I feel like the other thing is, and this will date us even more than your reference to being friends with someone for 20 years, is like when I first encountered Mobb Deep, the internet wasn't really what it was. I mean, I still think of the photo on the back of like the Infamous and just like being like, all right, like that's a thing, that's a world, that's a specific place. And the music really captured that in a way that's kind of impossible now, where it's like that guy had his references. They were like 20 people. They all live within 4 other boroughs of where he was, pretty much. And it just goes really deep into a relatively, what we would see as narrow.
Yeah, very local.
Suite of influences. Yeah. It's just like, these are what people are saying on Staten Island. You know, this is what people are saying up in Harlem. And this is what we're saying. And that's the dialogue. That's the slang. That's the competition. That's the world. And I'm going to rap about 4 square blocks. And a really specific worldview. And now, no matter where you are, you just get so much more information. The specificness of that music, I feel like you almost can't replicate now.
No. I'll never forget the first time I heard Eye for an Eye, which has Raekwon and Nas on it from Infamous. And I was just like, you know, you just feel like you're in like the end of 2001 when you're listening to those guys rap. Like it's, and what they're saying to each other and what they're rapping about and like this, the devil watching over New York City, and you know, it's just like all this, all the imagery in it. And I just remember being completely transported by that album and Hell on Earth. And of course he kind of had that renaissance later in his career with the solo album with HNIC.
He was also so young when he did that first record. I mean, for what we think of as the first record, I mean, obviously there's the Poetical Prophets and yada, yada, yada.
Cop Hell, you know, let's not forget Cop Hell. Very important.
Well, do you want to listen to Cop Hell? Should we listen to Cop Hell?
Sure.
All right, let's listen
to
Cop
DJ
Hell.
Premier.
A little Cop Hell for you.
As I walk the project, blacks trumped up, deployed on point for cops. Cause around my way, they try to turn it in or down. It seems like every time I turn around, I see one of my people's getting hemmed up. Either you run or it's a chance of getting buffed. Oh, what the hell? This is real and that's just how it is. That's how it is if I were just reading my own crib. A crew of blue pack and mad heat. But 5-4 better, no click, click. That's how we go in 92. Buck them down at all. Make them crawl to the upper floor. Straight to hell, you ask why. It ain't hard to figure. Cause they're quick to put a gap in and second over second phase with his finger on the trigger. Till I say no more, till his death he fell. Buck him in the face and let him rot in cop hell.
Chris, I had like a very similar connection with early Mobb Deep, but I think a lot of it had to do with seeing how young they were. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, obviously, you know, some people are tall, some people are short, but like they're small. They were small and they were young and they were hard and they were tragic and they were like infinitely wise. And that was so strange. Because when you think of young rappers, I mean, obviously a lot of rappers rap, you know, Nas was young when Illmatic came up, but his value proposition was just very different, like a young sage, and sort of treated as such in the hip hop world. There was sort of this kind of like resolute sadness around Mobb Deep. And part of that was because, oh God, like they're so young. And it's hard that we lost him, and it's hard that we lost him at a relatively young age. But I remember so much of the potency of hearing it for the first time was thinking, this is a sort of like horrifying and sublime thing to hear from someone who is this age.
And he was, and Prodigy was always really fragile. At a at a show, he looks relatively fragile. I mean, I remember at the when we saw him read from his book in Brooklyn, whatever, 2011, whatever it was.
Yes, yeah, at Powerhouse, yeah.
Powerhouse.
Shouts to Laura Jackaway.
And Elliot Wilson, who I think did that Q&A. But just always, like, kind of shoulders hunched, kind of just quiet in the corner. I remember Havoc, like, looking on, like, almost protectively. And they always had that thing of, like, yeah, he would, like, throw a TV at you, but he was also just, like, you're, like, it seems like you have three friends, possibly two to one friend. And this is just like your internal monologue, and it's like bleak and it's insane, but it's like not even insane. It's just like it's bleak and it's real and it's really honest. And he was sort of incapable, I think, of being anything else.
Sugarcoating.
Which was like,
there was no,
as years went on, it was like amazing how consistent it was. You know, the music wasn't always as good, but like you hear a Prodigy song and it was.
And also the book. I mean, I don't know if it, I think we've all maybe at least read at least part of the book. I mean, the book is, it's almost funny because it's just like one fight, and then you flip a page, and then it's like another fight, and it's just like every page there's like some new battle, and like some of it's about rap, and some of it's about streets, and some of it's about who knows what all else. But here is a guy who just literally like careened from battle to battle to battle, and was physically frail all the while. And, like, that never stopped him.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, the thing that I first connect, as hard as Shook Ones still is to this day, I definitely connected with the fragility a lot more as a teenager. And I remember hearing Drink Away the Pain and feeling like it was a pretty radical moment in rap, where, like, I just had never heard that kind of, like, sensitivity, depression, like, that very specific. Like, it was not hard for me to draw a direct line from, like, experiences in my life to that song. And it was not braggadocious. It was not like even angry. And then also thinking about like the fact that somebody like Prodigy and Havoc could have a musical relationship with Q-Tip was also a very mind-blowing thing for me, because they just seemed so different, and rap still seems very stratified. And like I didn't know, I wasn't inside of it. So the prospect of like Q-Tip making records for those guys about those things, I think kind of opened my mind to like what the shape of rap could be. But, you know, to me, he's like a very, like, not to be grandiose, but like Shakespearean, tragic, sad figure, you know, like being public about illness that he's battling, getting into all the fights that you're talking about, and the way that he writes about facing people down in the book, and just knowing that like he would just routinely get his ass kicked is like just a different prism through which to see a rapper.
And also, like, I mean, here's a guy who took perhaps one of the most public L's in all of rap beef history when Jay-Z puts that photo of him up at Summer Jam in 01, I think. Most people don't bounce back from that. Most people like go make Flo Rida records, or they move to Nebraska. Like, that's there's no second act after that. And Prodigy, I'm sure he was upset or angry or whatever, but I think Prodigy was also just like, yeah, I'm still Prodigy.
Yeah, he's like, I've been through this. This is like,
well,
this
is like
the 15th time this has happened. I'm ready.
Part of it was he never made himself into a giant. You know what I mean? Like, that was like the age of Oppo Research and beef songs. So it was like Jay doing these digging in his trash cans with some of the stuff that's in Ether and some of the stuff that was in, God, what was that?
Super Ugly.
Super Ugly, right.
That's brutal.
You know, and that's like all these brutal, gossipy songs. And P never really painted himself as like infallible or perfect. And that was also part of his appeal. I think that the other thing that really has struck me, because it's funny, I've been rewatching for a variety of reasons over the last couple of months, Stop Making Sense, the Talking Heads movie. And when they do the This Must Be the Place performance, and there's all these images of New York in the background, I find it like incredibly sad, you know, not only because Jonathan Demme passed along, but I think that you always hold New York in your head. And for the people who've left it, like, it's never the real place then. It becomes this sort of idea in your mind. And before I moved to New York, it was an idea that was largely shaped by Mobb Deep. Like, yeah. And even when I was there, there's always this paradox. Like, I remember when the Burn video came out, and it's like this black and white video that is ostensibly got all the hallmarks of like a shiny suit video, like in terms of like people are partying, there are girls, they're at a club. But it is the hardest shiny, it is like the most scratch shiny suit video. And it's like Noid is in it. And there's just like, there's motorcycles and everybody's smoking, you know, and everybody's got parkas on. And it's just like, it's not even like, and I remember thinking like, this is what like in my head, like New York is, it is the grimiest, shiniest thing in the world. And that is something that is getting farther and farther away from me as I get older and as I've like left the city. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of melancholy also just even talk about it, because I start to think about the what he soundtracked and the time of my life that he soundtracked. So it's kind of the same thing that you were talking about, as like it was the fragility that kind of spoke to you more than the largesse. And that's why he was sort of bulletproof when it came to those beefs. And they were, you cannot understate, like that also was pre-internet. It's impossible to understate how captivating that was. Yeah. I was not above that at all. I was just like, I'm on fire. I can't believe this is happening. When the reports of like what happened at Summer Jam happened. Like, were you at that Summer Jam?
I was not at that.
I was like, is this real life? Like, are we in a simulation? It was just incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend who talks about looking at like Sonic Youth records in the 90s and like reading the liner notes to figure out like who's Gerhard Richter. Like and just learn so much about culture that way. And I feel the same way about whether it be on the record where they'd have Raekwon on a song, whatever, and you kind of trying to figure out like what they're talking about back and forth, or the sort of Summer Jam lore that they built.
Or all the Pac stuff that's just still to this day kind of hearsay.
Yeah, exactly. And like who said what and did what to who. But it was like endless, and you could just, it would be like, okay, here's another name. You know, I'm gonna go figure out who this person is. You know, here's like an event that got referenced. Like, let me see if I can figure out what it is. And like, that's how you build the whole world. It was like, that was the pathway in for, I think, not just us, but like a lot of people, about just like being like, okay, what does this mean? I'm gonna figure it out.
And Prodigy was like a Zelig figure with all of the, like anything important that happened in basically from like 91 or 92 up until 2000. Prodigy intersects with in some
everybody.
Way, often with hostility. It's almost reassuring to know that throughout all these seasonal changes that could have upended what he was about and who he was, he remained very true to his purpose and to his art and to his positioning.
The song in Hell on Earth is Drop a Gem on Him, which is about,
oh my God. Yeah.
And even in Drop a Gem on Him, there are dudes in the song who were like, yo, chill. This is insane. What you're saying that is way too intense.
Original ad libs. Take that. Yeah. Take off.
I had a very funny editorial experience with Mobb Deep like 10 plus years ago. I was writing a review of a greatest hits Mobb Deep record, and it was edited by Josh Ells. Shout out to Josh Ells. And Josh's notes were like, I need you to tell me what this is besides horrifying.
It's a very blender edit.
It was a very specific peak blender edit.
I don't see a joke.
Yeah. For those of you who are not familiar with Blender, it was a magazine.
Where is the lie?
Yeah. Blender was a great music magazine, but it was often very hard to write about rap for that magazine because you're trying to send a very consistent, almost like spiritual message about the music. And they wanted something with a little bit more zip on it.
Yeah.
But I had a hard time like not making a John Carpenter reference when trying to describe what their music sounded like. And it's funny, like 10 plus years later, I have no problem with that. I feel it's very easy for me to communicate like what Prodigy meant and what Have meant and why their music was so important. But it's too late now, so I don't write Blender anymore.
It be a buck 50, your chance of running is infinity. Believe it, arms like a chip slipped in. I'm so on the low and taking Navy SEAL to get me when I surface. If not chips, then vengeance to purpose. On your team, I pull the curtain, a beautiful hurting. Till my eyes see the blood, that mean the creep start working. Cats are never learning, let their eyes keep lurking. Have ya, the limits pumping, your X5 murking. Skim off the street, heart skip the beat. Bitch, kid, I overcooked that meat. Get no sleep, only rest is in between the blink. My life story was written in blood, permanent ink. Right. Instinct,
R.I.P. I'm gotta think like that, cause forever I'll be needing them. Playing flawless, mistakes never beating them. Some love me, some hate me, chickens in the head beating them. Cowboys wanna ride by the crib all slow. Clap my you want a real rap show. It's a rush when the blow, threaten my castle. And in the blink, watch how quick life pass you.
What's wrong with motherfuckers? But when they ever learn, keep playing with that fire, let it get burned.
Speaking of that era, something that is happening because we are all old now and on that.
This is the Country for Old Men podcast.
Yeah, like, we are inexorably moving towards death.
Yeah.
Is that that era of music and of our childhood passion is now just becoming documentary fodder and is now just turning into a period of time that's like, well, you can make another Bob Dylan movie, or you can make a movie about Dr. Dre, or you can, Puff can just make a movie about whatever the hell Puff wants to make a movie about. And we have seen in the last couple weeks, both of those things happen. You have the Defiant Ones on HBO, which started a few days ago and goes for the next couple weeks, which is about Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine and their long-running bromance. Not that you would really feel bromantic after watching Defiant Ones, weirdly. And then there's Can't Stop, Won't Stop, which is sort of a glorified tour documentary with Puff. But anything where you see who he has become, knowing where he came from, is vigorous television or film or whatever it is.
Revolt TV?
Peak TV, yes.
Revolt, I don't... I'm,
Peak Revolt TV.
Is it Revolt TV?
I'm pretty sure my cable provider does not service Revolt TV. Is this like... Does this count like an official...
Is Tidal your cable provider?
Yeah. Yeah. So I have seen all of these movies. I know you guys have seen varying amounts of the movies. I'm curious to talk a little bit about the Dre and Jimmy thing, because like Jay earlier, Dre doesn't talk.
No.
Like, just at all. Like, just doesn't talk. We got a quote from him when my colleague Joe Coscarelli was reporting about the Dee Barden situation, pegged to Straight Outta Compton. And we only got a quote because I assume, and who knows what the backstage machinations were, we called, you know, Apple for a comment because Dre's an Apple executive. And I assume at some point... that means Dre has to comment about the situation.
The machinations of working at a Silicon Valley massive corporation.
Like you have to, right, you have to apologize for a bad thing you did 25 years prior.
I don't know who Dee Barnes is, but you need to get on the phone right now.
Yeah. So Dre doesn't talk. And a thing that I kind of liked about this film, and it happens a little bit more in the later episodes, was there is a comfort that I think Dre has with Alan Hughes and who is the director and who conducted almost all the interviews, where I think he felt like he could like loosen his shoulders a little bit. He's still not very revealing, but it's an interesting portrait of that particular time in music making and the Interscope Records era. And it's, you know, when you think of all the things that Jimmy put out in the 90s, it's kind of like, oh, all right, you know.
I think it's a pretty clever conceit for a documentary, actually.
It doesn't feel very revealing, but I enjoyed watching it.
It's revealing in the ways that it's, like, not revealing. Like, almost to your exact point about Dre, which is, like, here's a guy who's been successful since the 80s, massively successful, famous five different ways, and he is still a very thin-skinned, awkward, tense person. Mm-hmm. And, I mean,
so
you look at...
producer.
Yeah, what?
So he's a producer.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but it's
but
like
that's the thing.
It's like you look at Jimmy, who kind of came up in a similar, albeit like more Springsteen related way, and he's just like extremely comfortable in his own skin, and like, I mean, he's got his like his lines and his stories, but he's like at ease. Whereas Dre, even just the basic stuff, he sometimes just looks like he's in pain talking about it, which is just it's just fascinating that you. That you can have that much success and that much money and still be sort of have that much trouble interfacing with the world. And obviously that's not what the documentary is about,
but
it's like
it
a
tells.
Fascinating subplot, just kind of watching him try to open up and just kind of fail.
Also, like many of the best modern day shots of Dre are of him alone. And Jimmy's in this modern day, obviously he's being interviewed alone, but the sort of pickup on Jimmy is him interacting with people, and the pickup with Dre is like almost exclusively alone. It's like him looking out over, I assume, the Pacific Ocean at his Malibu house. It's him in the Bahamas playing Kraftwerk on his computer. It's him in the studio with, I guess, an engineer who, like, I don't even know who knows that engineer's name. He's just like, kid, press button and like, let me just like do what I do. Whereas Jimmy is like very clearly like...
Yeah, and think about the way that they set the tension for the whole movie. The first 10 minutes are dedicated to this gaffe that Dr. Dre and Tyrese started when they revealed the sale price of Beats when Apple bought the company.
Where is the Tyrese Gibson biopic?
Yeah. Define Ones Part 2. We're coming for you, Tyrese.
Oh, my God.
Tyrese and maybe Josh Duhamel, and they can talk about their partnership on various Transformers projects. But the fact that that reveals Jimmy's sort of discomfort with Dre's inability to be more of an executive, and I think Dre's inability to be anything beyond a producer and an artist, is kind of the underlying tension of the whole story. Yep. And it's his inability to talk about his brother's death, the Dee Barnes incident, really anything that creates a modicum of discomfort for him. And that's like pretty fascinating. And even with someone like Alan Hughes, who Dre has known for, I think, 30 plus years, he still can't really get to the core of why he did things he doesn't feel good about, or what pain really is.
Refuses
to on camera.
Yeah.
Which is understandable, but it creates an interesting managed bubble around some of this movie, which I actually quite like. But somebody like Jimmy, Zach, as you said, who's so good at just telling his Patti Smith story now, and who's so good at explaining like how he gave a Tom Petty song to Stevie Nicks. That feels like the kind of hagiographic documentary
the
about
kids
any
stays
artist
in the picture
you've seen.
Type.
Yeah. Yeah. That, yeah. People, we've been watching those for 40 years. The Dre thing is kind of a new form, like sort of like unwilling participant who's also a producer and willing.
Yeah, it's also, Dre's had such an interesting career. Jimmy's found that there is no ceiling for like an energetic runner. You know what I mean? Like that is like,
sure.
He was relentless about getting on in the beginning. You know what I mean? He had some hurdles and he like corrected his mistakes. And he was just like, he has always merged this idea of producer is not necessarily a sonic architect as
technical,
much as he is like
thing.
A general, like a front office GM for the record.
He's a connector.
And not for nothing does like every other artist in there have an anecdote about him talking about how much money they're going to make.
Yeah.
Like Tom Petty. He kept talking about money. I don't understand.
Yeah, and it's like the almost famous style, like, you know, what does Fallon say when he comes in? It's just like, what's his like tagline when he replaces him in Almost Famous? He's just like, do respect. You know, like that guy who comes in and like that kind of reminds me of Jimmy. Dre is a guy who hired musicians to replay samples. Like, that's the level of personality we're dealing with, you know, and he always seemed like a very closed off musician to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I actually don't have for as much passion as I spoke about with Prodigy. I have the complete opposite for Dre's music. Even though I respect it, even though it is soundtracked almost all of my life from like 13 on, I don't have much of an affection for it. And part of it is that it's not messy at all. And it's interesting that to hear you guys talk about...
Well, I feel like The Chronic is a little messy, but I know what you mean.
Not because of him.
Longer conversation.
Yeah, but this is just feeling. You know what I mean? Like, I just never connected with his music. And I think part of it might be... And yeah, you're right. There's a lot... Obviously, like, there's exceptions to the rule. But I do think that he is a perfectionist. He is somebody who you hear about... He's almost like Fincher-esque. And like, he'll have people repeat takes of the end of bars to get the phrasing right on just one thing.
It's in the documentary.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just managing every other person in the studio like they're an instrument.
Which explains why... He's had a spotty record of releasing music since probably peak Eminem, right? I mean, in terms of producing, the streets are paved with our Aftermath contracts.
Which is why it was actually strange to hear him relating the tale of the first Eminem session where everything happened so spontaneously, because that seems the complete opposite of what Dr. Dre is good. And you're like, oh, if you can get 80% of the way with this kind of improvisational style, or like, then maybe you could put out a record every 2 years. But it's like, it's like in shipping, it's the last mile problem.
Does Drew Haas show up at any future Defiant Ones to talk about music? I was always wondering, like, what was that? Like, the story was that he was going to be on Black Moon's label, and Dre took him, or did they like give? Was how did that happen?
I don't know if it was
like,
ever.
They don't
officially...
really get into that in the doc.
Yeah. In the index at the end of the index at the end of the doc, there is no 5-foot accelerator entry in the index.
They don't get it.
I don't know. It was also interesting watching Defiant Ones up against watching Puff, because the Puff in Can't Stop Won't Stop is gregarious and like just had a facial and like just like living incredibly well, and like comes directly from not just the same era, but the same kind of conceptual approach. You know, what Dre did with G-Funk, Puff did with 70 Soul, this sort of turning into exuberant rap music. And they were constantly in dialogue with each other throughout the 90s, both positively and negatively, musically and street stuff. And they're both, obviously, look, they're both super wealthy, you know, like no knocks on anybody's financial well-being. But it's interesting to see how much fun Puff is having and how little fun Dre seems to be having.
I think it's because Puff is more like Jimmy than he is like Dre. Yeah. You know, I think ultimately Puff is kind of a visionary, a self-described visionary, mm-hmm. who's more interested in the narrative and the connectivity and the legacy. And I think Dre is more obsessed with answering the call in his brain. You know, that's trying to find the sound, the unquenchable thirst for that sound. And, you know, Puff obviously has artistic inspiration and he's made a lot of songs that I really like, mm-hmm. but I've never been like, man, Puff is a musical genius.
Yeah, and he's always, his sort of value proposition as an artist has always been like, he's one of those guys who can just put a personality across. Who can just be like, I'm this guy who loves life. I have a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I live really well and entertainingly well. And I can just create that in three dimensions on a song, off a song. That was why he worked as an artist, although he wasn't the greatest rapper or producer or. So I feel, you know, and it's like, I do think like one of the most fascinating things about the Dre and Jimmy Doc are like, you kind of called it out in your review, those weird moments where they're like, we need to tune this Chrysler for the same, you know, the thing that we're like endorsing. And it's just like, these are the daily lives of like weird rich executives who happen to make their money in music, mm-hmm. but are kind of like almost, that's not the life that they mm-hmm. lead. Whereas Puff is just like, I'm still here being myself and I love it.
Making dudes run across bridges to get me cake. Yeah.
and Puff appears as sort of a tertiary character in The Defiant Ones, like calling Jimmy to get Jimmy to confirm. And of course, Puff's not going to call Dre. I mean, Puff calls Jimmy. And Puff, like, who more than Jimmy wants to know about the $3.2 billion deal?
He has a lot of Jimmy in him, too. Yeah.
So who more than Jimmy? Of course, Puff is picking up the phone to call because Puff is like that. I want $3.2
billion. He needs to know. How can I be like that?
I'm a motherfucker.
Okay, so we're back and Rap is Dead, guys. How?
We're all worth $3.2 billion.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Congratulations. We did it. It's over. To close out the podcast, you know, we've been talking a lot about stuff from our younger years and folks who are sort of struggling to maintain relevance in an ever-changing environment. Let's just go straight to the change. That was Lil Peep. That is Beamer Boy. And that is Lil Peep, who is probably going to be on Z100 12 months from now. Sean, I know you have some emotions about this song.
I feel very honored to be here with the grand dame of
the Beamer Boy SoundCloud movement. Yeah.
I think
do you want to see my goth boy click tattoo?
Well, I specifically remember you telling me that you were working on this story a few months ago and we were having dinner, and I was like, I just don't know what you're talking about, and I don't really have time to figure it out. And it was the first time I think I ever felt like I don't have time to figure out what this is. And then lo and behold, I had a lot of time on my hands on a long drive over the weekend, and I got to figuring out what it was. And, you know, as with all things in youth culture, I'm still, like, attracted to something.
Sean is wearing a tie
now.
I'm
wearing a tie.
It's worth saying Sean is wearing a tie.
It's an aggressive pattern on the tie and hard-bottom shoes. However, Lil Peep works.
I mean, they're McNary.
He's underselling this because I was on the other end of Sean's drive. And when he arrived, he came into a Cheesecake Factory-esque restaurant where I was eating some spinach dip, and he had a look on his face that he gets 6 to 10 times a year when he experiences something that he's genuinely excited about. Not necessarily loves, not necessarily connected by, but like when he finds something and he's like, this is a thing, and it's legit. And he sat down and he was just like, you got to see this dude's inspirations playlist. It's like, I just peeked into the future. Now, he had just driven through a desert, but it was a significant and sincere reaction. It wasn't just like, oh, this is kind of amusing.
Yeah, and it's not anything that John wasn't like 6 months early on, but it became clear to me very, very quickly, like what was happening and what these guys are doing and why it's effective and why I think I'm thinking of my 13-year-old sister and how I can just see her connecting to this in about 2 years.
Was he from Long Island?
And from Long Island. I mean, and imagine the privilege to listen to Lil Peep.
Look on Long Island.
Although to be fair, like the thing about Lil Peep is like he represents that privilege. The influences that he's synthesizing are like
are like
classic suburban kid, like, oh, I like My Chemical Romance, but also Odd Future and, you know, whatever. And I don't see the difference between
this is the reverse of the thing that we were talking about earlier about what you were asking, like, do people, the younger people that we work with, care about Jay-Z anymore? This is the other side of it, where there are things that are forming artists that were on the back end of what I considered to be like good music. So Good Charlotte and Sum 41 and Gucci, who have varying degrees of like relevance to me, Gucci being at the top probably. Mm-hmm. But to hear someone who's like, those are the Beatles, the Stones, and the Kinks to me, that's just really eyeball shattering.
Also, I think, and this is something that I think I spoke about, not in the piece, maybe on the SoundCloud Rap podcast. I feel like I'm maybe the only one at this table that has been to a Warped Tour in the last 10 years or 15 years.
Never been to one in my life.
Zach, you?
Informative years. I was like a fan.
Right. But I mean, as like sort of like a having a little distance.
As the oldest man there? No. I know.
Well, you wouldn't have been, because I would have been the oldest man there. Except the guy who was fronting like Unwritten Law or whatever.
Fat Mike is probably older than everybody.
Fat Mike was like 40 in like the 90s.
Okay. So when I started this job, a thing that I did is I covered concerts very aggressively. That was like sort of the meat and potatoes of the job. And so I had never previously been in Warped Tour because I did not care about punk music growing up. It just wasn't on my radar at all. And so I started going to Warped Tour and trying to piece together the sort of like aesthetic arcs and arguments. And the first couple of years I went, I feel like was the tail end of maybe like the mainstreaming sort of emo, but like not really. So not major label stuff, but stuff that was maybe like
Newfound Glory.
Yeah, like one click below, basically. And then an interesting thing started to happen probably around 2009, 2010, is you started having screamo bands, you had metalcore bands, melodic hardcore bands, who all clearly were listening to rap music. And they were all clearly, you know, if they were using a drum machine or they had a drummer who was sort of like emulating certain kinds of familiar patterns. And I thought this was baffling because I was like, oh, like, why? No one here seems like they listen to rap music. And then you had that epiphany moment where I was like, oh, right, everyone listens to rap music.
Pop music.
Literally no person doesn't listen to rap music. And so for 2 or 3 years there, a lot of the big bands I felt like were hip-hop influence. And even like when you started getting into like the weird, I'm going to say crabcore stuff, which is like not a real thing.
I forgot about crabcore.
But like Attack, and sounds like that.
It certainly is.
What podcast is this?
Maximum Rock and Roll.
Alternative Press.
Yeah. Punk Planet, issue 17.
But I remember being so struck, and I was like, oh, I wonder what the end game of this is. Because it seemed after 2 or 3 years that it kind of leveled off. It wasn't evolving into something new. It just was a synthesis that became the norm. And now I realize what it evolved into is Lil Peep.
I think in the past, it used to be, you know, this isn't the first time this has happened. Like, I remember when Sublime came out, I was like, oh, this is what the white boys are going to do to rap. They're going to make it all bands.
Right.
And they're going to take the ethic and the point of view, but they're just going to apply it to their kind of rock sound. Mm-hmm. And then this is going to be the future of young music.
Shouts to Time Flies.
Yeah, that didn't really happen. And like now what's happening, which is interesting, is it's like, it's not the bands that you're talking about specifically, but it's like individuals who are like, I am a rapper, but I might as well like be in Ocean Avenue.
Yeah, but I'm going to say, and this is, and again, I feel like I said this on the last podcast, it's like the thing that makes Peep interesting is like we all get excited about rappers who sound like they're singing, and he's a singer who sounds like he's rapping. And that's just not something that's really happened at this level. It's happened in bits and pieces, but not with someone who's so thoroughly synthesized. And when I interviewed him, we were talking about collaborations, and like I said, oh, you know, what about someone like Young Thug? And he was just like, that is my literal dream. Like, that is like the most exciting thing. And of course, like a guy like Thug, who basically is a Funhouse mirror version of Lil Peep, of course that's who he would connect to the most intensely.
Do you think that he's more of a product of something like Fall Out Boy, who obviously had
too
like,
soft?
Or is it like something that could only have happened after like Makonnen?
Oh, McConan was important to him.
Yeah.
For sure. McConan was
important. Did they talk about like the Wayne period where Lil Wayne picks up a guitar and gets really into it? Are they up on that oeuvre?
No one mentioned it.
Because that
to me.
Seems to me like, in a way, like the antecedent that was like the biggest on the rap side. I mean, prior to Thug and all those guys coming through.
I wonder if that, what, were there any real hits from that Wayne period?
No.
I can't think of one.
No, but it's funny that you bring up Wayne. I mean, last night we were talking about Lil Wayne's reemergence last week and him jumping on the aforementioned Playboi Carti's Magnolia and feeling, my contention was like he stole the song, you know, and now it's Wayne's song, which is something he did all the time from 2005 through 2009 and lost basically when he picked up that guitar. I mean, he kind of vacated that ability, but you were saying the opposite.
Yeah.
And I think that I've been thinking about it being the opposite, which is like, this is Playboi Carti's song forever. In the same way that like trying to imagine Wayne getting on a Lil Peep song almost it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter. Like it would lose something essential, even though it's less powerful in its rapping and like less artistic even in some ways, but it's Lil Peep is just so sui generis, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting to talk about, because we talked about this with Jay earlier, like could Jay have done an album where he's basically just doing anti-flows? And when you think about the rappers who are like the most exciting right now, whether it's the SoundCloud kids, you know, someone like Pump or Smoke Perp, or
dude named Smoke Perp. Is there?
Yes.
Great.
You really didn't read my SoundCloud about these. That's like the complete takeaway from today's trip to Sunset Gower is Chris Ryan did not read the SoundCloud rap piece in print or online.
Is the live sound of an eroding friendship.
Wow. Fire.
I have a stack of papers I'm going to get.
Are you holding them up to your ear?
That's right.
Just a bunch of A&Ls held up to your ear. I like to see that on Instagram.
I
got to
get through the
week.
Haberman archives and then you're next.
Point being, we have what feels like a generation of kind of like anti-flow rappers. And whether it's Peep and Perp, whether it's Cardi, 21 Savage, these are guys. And it's like, you don't want to say that they are, that it's not a sort of artistic decision, but it is definitely a different, it's almost like rapping from the bottom up as opposed to top down, building verses and building flows and structures from the outside.
Can I throw an uninformed theory at you?
Yeah.
You tell me if I'm right.
Why?
Are
why
these
stop
guys
now?
A product of an eroding music industry? Is this like a product of basically that A&R class and that like, okay, so here is the logical progression of your career. This is how you do it. Like, you're going to make this record and then this record, and then you're going to get this producer and this feature, and then we're going to put you on this tour and you're going to make this album. And now that that has been finally and fully smashed, and the access to entry is basically as much as a laptop costs and a microphone costs, is this like the product of that? The product of that disillusion of like the typical process?
Well, this is also, I mean, they're in the... In an article I wrote about SoundCloud rap, which you should really read, Chris.
What's SoundCloud rap?
You know, there's this sort of ongoing conversation within the genre and also by the people who are starting to glom onto the genre about its punk ethos and thinking about breaking down a genre to its constituent parts.
I was just thinking about that because you were sort of saying that like Peep would be on like the Z100 in a year. And in a way, it's like, the arc of this seems very similar to some of the Warped Tour stuff you're describing. Of it starts very punk, and it's like we're gonna take the anthemicness and the boasting out, and we're gonna make it interior and weird and difficult, and up the barrier to entry and put it on SoundCloud, and it's just gonna be strange, like equivalent of 7 inches or whatever in the 90s. And now I feel like some of these artists you can tell are like a year or two away from like being the Jimmy Worlds or whatever of the thing.
Absolutely.
Where they take that ethos, put a little bit more melody and like A&R behind it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you have
totally agree.
Extremely popular music.
And this is actually, I mean, obviously a couple of these guys have signed to imprints of major labels already. And I can't imagine, you know, I know some of these executives and I can't imagine they're going to be like, cool, just keep doing this complete lo-fi, no melody, no, like half a hook, like show up and like rap for 4 seconds, and then we'll just loop that 30 times. Like, I don't think that's gonna be the thing. There's sort of like a running joke about there being like an industry plant Lil Pump or an industry plant XXXTentacion. And like, there may well be, and that may be actually the person who becomes like the Rick Ross of this generation. It may not be one of these kids, it may be one of the sort of fake kids.
I could credibly see Peep and Pump though, which is an amazing thing to be saying out loud.
Mm-hmm. What about Perp though?
To remind everyone Sean's wearing like a tie right now, shirts tucked in, belt
so,
visible.
As I was saying about youth music, I could actually see Peep and Pump, who look very similar, have a sort of like similar like pink haired, dreadlocked, face tatted visual execution.
Peep shaved his head though.
I did not. I'm not up on the most recent.
Okay. Just letting you know.
Peep information.
Shout.
However,
shout to the V-Lo runway
peep
show.
Tumblr.
But I could see them both being peep pretty famous, and they sound actually radically different to me. And they're making music that is completely divergent, even though they look so similar. And there is something interesting about the fact that they're both plausible. Like I don't know that we necessarily need a plan. I think the fact that XXXTentacion is the most successful and most controversial figure inside of it, he is almost like the invading agent to create some space for this thing. And I think he's also radioactive to a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Because of that, it will be hard for him
to
go forward.
Yeah.
And these two sort of, I mean, it's fascinating that Lil Pump in particular has basically created this animated version of himself that is how he presents to the world. Every single cover is a funny caricature drawing of him. And that's for 14-year-olds. You know what I mean? All of his songs are 2 minutes and 4 seconds long, and that's good for Spotify streams. Like, there's something strategic about what some of these guys are doing that is very interesting to me.
It'll be interesting to watch Peep and Pump side by side, because Peep's path, and he said this to me for the story, he's like, I'm not a SoundCloud rapper. Like, I mean, I started out that way. That's not what I am. He's also white and, like, very conventionally handsome and, like, you know, I think wants to be a huge pop star. It will be interesting to see what happens when we have come to associate mainstream rap stardom with maximalism. Like, it's become sort of the easy, oh, you want to describe what a radio record? It's maximalist. It's all these things. Nothing about this next wave is maximalist. And the fact that it has such a committed fan base so early, I don't know if you guys have watched any of the footage from the Rolling Loud Festival, which is the Miami festival in May, where Lil Uzi Vert did the stage dive from like 20 feet up. But like, you watch the footage of, you know, of Pump or X or Wi-Fi, and you see, you know, there's 10,000 kids.
It's a small sample size, but I also feel like I keep seeing videos of these dudes getting knocked out on stage.
Yeah. Essentially, there's two main cliques. There's two main sides, and they really hate each other. And I think there's just going to continue to be friction until everybody has enough money that they don't want to put their money at risk.
This is a very hacky comparison, but I'm going to make it. It feels a little bit like grunge. And it feels like mm-hmm. it's a little bit on the precipice of it being commodified in a very specific kind mm-hmm. of way. Obviously, the music industry is very different now. But if the right handful of people kind of get their arms around this, I could see a world in which
Top Man presents Goth Boy Click.
I mean, if that's not already
Woodcop.
Woodcop. If that's not already happening, people are slipping on the job. All right, should we go out with Molly?
Let's do it.
Great.
This is Lil Pump.
I got designer from head to my toe. I'm a designer, my best new the coat. I got DaVinci all over my coat. I'm on the X and I jump on the foe. I'm on the Molly, I'm on the bean. 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 Lil Pump rich, he finna get richer. I pop a bean, then fuck off your sister. Nut on her lip and then go kiss her.
Thank you for listening to the New York Times podcast. Thank you to my dear friends and guests, Zach Barron, Chris Ryan, Sean Fennessy. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us your favorite Lil
Haberman.
You can email us your favorite Lil Pump YouTube clip at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast for more enlightening conversations like these at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producers this week are Jim Cunningham in Los Angeles and Pedro Rosado in New York. I've been your host, John Caramonica. We're back next week.
Haber's gonna have.
I got designer from head to my toe. I'm on the Zen and my best new the coat. I got DaVinci all over my coat. I'm on the X and I jump on the foe. I'm on the Molly, I'm on the bean. I'm on the Molly, I'm on the bean. I'm on the Molly, I'm on the bean. I'm on the Molly, I'm on the bean.